This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Libby will be back on Wednesday. Another restriction is being lifted in breaking news. The interprovincial border restriction between Ontario and Manitoba and Ontario and Quebec is being lifted as of Wednesday morning at 12:01. It was in effect until tomorrow, so the Ford government has decided to lift the interprovincial border restrictions with Quebec and Manitoba, another sign that the pandemic situation is improving. One of these signs has been the patios that have been open in Ontario for 3 days now as part of the Step 1 reopening. Today, well, actually, it's improving very nicely, but much earlier we had a lot of rain. So outdoor dining, not great for earlier today, but on the weekend, wow, was that perfect patio weather. How was your experience and how was your attitude? Were you more understanding as staff was trying to get acclimatized to getting back to serving? Did you tip more than usual, or are you still avoiding any kind of gathering scenario on the patios for now? Numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free, 1-866-740-4740. To get the perspective of the restaurateur, we're joined by Damon Bodnar, owner of Hemingway's in Yorkville, and Chef Brooke Kavanaugh, owner of Season 6 Restaurant. Hello, gentlemen.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Oh, you're great. How's it going? And much better now that the patios are open. It is a pastime here in Toronto, to be sure. Damon, you opened at the stroke of midnight, first thing on Friday. How was that?
Yeah, we opened 12:01 Friday morning. It was fantastic. It was a good little couple of hours to be open leading into a crazy, high-demand weekend. So we were, patrons were happy, staff were very happy. I think they were smiling behind their masks. But it was good to be back.
So that was the overall atmosphere, was just jubilation on both sides.
Yeah, you know what? Like, there was definitely a little bit of rust. Starting off a beautiful Friday was a challenge. But the public health guidelines and the protocols that we have in place are very similar to that they were at the end of last summer. So there was a real comfort level for our staff and a real comfort level for our patrons. So, it went really well.
And Brooke, what about you in Season 6?
Well, my experience was maybe a bit unique. We actually just opened this location a month ago. We opened our first location on April 1st of last year, right at the beginning of the pandemic. And we had opened in a little 250 square foot basement, Dundas and Ossington. We opened a restaurant that was kind of ideally suited for the pandemic. It was a little takeaway and delivery place that we had conceived of prior to the pandemic. Not necessarily because we didn't have ambitions to open a proper restaurant with seating one day, but just that's the size of a restaurant my wife and I could afford to open. Mm-hmm. So we ended up getting really lucky, and we did quite well during the first year, and we're able to take a much larger space with a liquor license and a patio. So we weren't just opening for the first time in a year. We were opening the first time ever for the two of us, a restaurant with seating and with service. Luckily, we both worked for a long time in the industry, so we know what we're doing, and we ended up having a great day. It started a little rocky, though. I was up at 7 a.m. to get to the Home Depot to buy the things we needed to finish off the bathrooms that we hadn't finished renovating.
Right.
And when we were told that we'd be able to open on Friday instead of Monday, we were in a rush to get things sorted. So I was buying, a paper towel rack and toilet paper holders and mirrors and sconces for the walls in the bathrooms and installing those at the same time as setting up the patio for the first time and preparing for our first day of very busy day. We went from doing, maybe $1,500 a day in sales to four times that amount on our first day. So it was not easy. I was running around like a madman for 17 hours.
Well, let's talk about that in terms of recouping losses. Damon, Hemingway's is long established in Yorkville. Is there any fear or concern that your establishment or others aren't going to make it now as a result of not being able to serve in person for so long?
So, you know what? I think there has been some real challenges, and I think all restaurants have been through a real tough time over the last 40 months with different restrictions and different closing. Some of the subsidies that if businesses were eligible for them, they definitely helped. But you can't look back. You've got to look forward. We're not going to make up the losses that we've had over the last 40 months. Our staff aren't going to. There are opportunities to earn are forward now. So, you know, we're taking what we've been granted for operating hours and so forth now, and we're just looking forward. I think if we focus too much on trying to recoup, we won't focus what's in front of us, which is our customer, and what's ahead of us, and that's hopefully a long, beautiful summer.
And Brooke, it looks to me from the story you've told, you and your wife, you have an optimistic future.
Oh, absolutely. We have a lot of ambitions. We're opening a second restaurant in our old location. We're definitely trying to expand, but the challenge right now is certainly staff. As has been widely reported, with everyone launching back into service at the same time, it's been really tricky. A lot of the people that were working in the industry prior to the pandemic have moved on. It wasn't a luxurious industry to work in at the beginning, before the pandemic. So, you know, people that were maybe on the fence about whether they wanted to stick it out have found work in other industries. You know, the film industry has been doing remarkably. They were never really shut down by any great extent during the pandemic. So a lot of people have moved over and have become, you know, workers in that industry. So certainly staffing is our biggest challenge right now. And I'm sure a lot of other restaurateurs would agree with that. Yeah.
What about, Damon, what about the professional serving staff that, you know, have made a profession of serving tables and are clearly above and beyond those who are just starting out in the business? How have they made out?
Well, that's exactly right. Some of the professionals that make a career out of hospitality, and there are a lot of us, it's been a really challenging time. We've been fortunate. We've had our team, the majority of our team, come back. The staffing is a challenge. Like you are going into a really busy season, so everyone's trying to not just reopen but ramp up to summer volumes at the same time. But I do think that people will start to come back to hospitality, and your seasoned veterans for sure. They're here. They're ready to go. Our kitchen, as an example, they've all stuck around. They're ready to. They launched back with us day one, and I think the summer students and some of the international students and some of the part timers in the summer. I think, you know, now that we're a few days into it, I really hope that they'll start to come back.
Well, let's talk about the clientele. I know my husband and I, we went out on Friday night with a couple friends of ours, and we were just so happy to be on a patio. And the atmosphere, as we were saying in the beginning, was really joyful. And they didn't have certain drinks and, you know, the food wasn't as hot as it could have been. But it almost didn't seem to matter, Brooke, because, you know, it's such a beloved activity for people in the GTA to go to a patio. It just felt good to be back.
Oh, yeah. You could see that on everyone's faces. You could tell that people really feeling for the people in hospitality. There was a real generosity that we experienced from everyone on the patio that day.
Well, that's nice to hear. What about you, Damon? Same customers were accommodating and respect.
We was happy to be out. We're happy to be in safe, comfortable environment. There was definitely a lot of joy and man, I hope that continues throughout the summer. But it was fantastic. Yes.
Just, one more, topic, before we wrap up the segment here, in terms of the assistance that you've been given by the City of Toronto, by the province of Ontario, I've heard, you know, we've heard from various business organizations, independent business organizations, that it has not been adequate. Brooke, I'll start with you. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, you can always use more help. And I think squeaky wheel gets the grease. So, you know, I'm going to just appreciate what we've got, and being able to use these great Cafe TO patios has been huge for us. So I'm just counting my blessings right now.
Brooke, is that something, do you think, that will ultimately revitalize the industry? Is this Patio TO program?
Well, it certainly has already. It's a huge boost for a business like us that doesn't have a proper patio. Being able to use the street, it's massive. It's a huge win for us.
And Damon, what about you in terms of the help that the City of Toronto, the province of Ontario, has given to restaurateurs?
Yeah, so I think that the subsidies that were in place, they definitely kept a lot of businesses afloat. Did they remove all losses that restaurants and hospitality had? No, absolutely not. We ran at a loss. I have a place, the Gym Pub off on St. Clair, a smaller place. We ran at a loss month on month. Did it help? Absolutely. Did it give us an opportunity to reopen on opening day? Yes. But are we carrying losses through all of this? Yes, we are. And what I do hope for is that these subsidies don't just get cut off now. Like they need to at least run till, say, September, October, till the end of the start or the beginning of the fall. There's some uncertainty what the fall will bring. So the subsidies are great, but they do need to remain in place.
And post-pandemic, just one final thought here, in terms of practices or standards that have had to be implemented during the COVID-19 crisis, Brooke, how will the ripple effect of that be once we're finished with this thing?
Well, I think a lot of these practices that are in place are, you know, it's good hygiene, and it's good if we can continue with them even, you know, beyond the pandemic, you know, whether it's seasonal flu or whatnot, just being adamant about, you know, making sure everything's properly sanitized is good. Now, in terms of distancing, I'm not a doctor, and I would never say that, but I will say that as a restaurateur, I sincerely hope that we'll be able to have as many patrons in as our capacity allows once the pandemic is over.
Damon, final thoughts on that? Post-pandemic, life beyond COVID?
Yeah, I agree. I think the distancing makes it very difficult for restaurateurs to get their liquor license capacity. But you know what? We've probably learned a lot from this. There's you know, little things like QR codes and having online menus. And I think the industry as a whole has some protocols that we've put in place throughout the pandemic that will continue on in the future.
Well, I hope the sunny weather continues for you both, because we all know people go in droves when the weather is good. Thank you both for sharing your stories with us.
Thank you.
No worries. Good.
Damon Bodnar is owner of Hemingway's in Yorkville, and Chef Brooke Kavanaugh is the owner of Season 6 Restaurant. Jane for Libby, and coming up next here on Zoomer Radio's Fight Back, how to improve safety and living situations for Toronto's homeless after 3 encampment fires over the weekend. That's next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to 1. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Libby is off for a couple of days. She will be back on Wednesday. Fires in homeless encampments continue to be an issue and a safety hazard for those who live in them. This morning, Toronto's Chief Communications Officer Brad Ross posted that Toronto Fire Services dealt with as many as 3 encampment fires in the city over the last 72 hours. There were no injuries, but this issue hits close to home here at the Zoomerplex, since Liberty Village had its very own encampment for quite a lengthy period of time before it was dismantled a number of weeks ago by the city and Toronto police officers. Brad Ross joins us now with an update. Thanks for the time, Brad.
Hi, good afternoon, Jane.
So what happened over the weekend? Tell us the stories of these fires.
Yeah, so unfortunately, we had two fires under the Gardiner Expressway, one at York and Lakeshore, and another near Spadina and Lakeshore, and then one at Alexandra Park that you just referred to, which unfortunately there are still some structures there. That happened at about 1 a.m. So thankfully, in all three cases, there were no injuries, but it does continue to speak to the safety concerns, the very real safety concerns that we at the city and at Toronto Fire have about the situation in encampments.
Well, and isn't that evidence, this dismantling a couple of weeks ago by Toronto Police and the city, that maybe this form of dismantling doesn't work?
Well, I mean, what we do and what we have been doing throughout the pandemic is making safe indoor space available to people in these encampments. We have referred more than 1,600 people, in fact, into safe indoor space. But there continue to be people who are not accepting those offers and are staying in these encampments. We have, in the last, since 2020, in fact, responded to 253 fires in encampments. So we see gasoline cans, we see propane, a lot of debris, and so it is terribly concerning. And so, yes, we are, we posted notices, for example, at encampments indicating that you cannot set up structures in parks, you cannot camp in parks, and you certainly can't have fires in encampments. And so we continue to work through that. We continue to connect with people who are living in these encampments, people who are experiencing homelessness, to refer them to safe inside space where they will have, most importantly, access to a housing worker to find permanent housing. As we go through this that process, we do remain very concerned about fires in encampments, and Toronto Fire have removed, as I was just referring to, propane tanks and gasoline cans to not just protect the people who are living in those encampments, but our first responders as well, and the public in the vicinity of these encampments.
I'd like to invite our listeners to get involved in the conversation as well. We're talking about Toronto's homeless encampments and fires, which continue to be prevalent, as you've just heard from Brad Ross at the City of Toronto. Numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. Brad, if we look back, do some reverse engineering on Toronto's homeless situation, how did it get to this point? How did it get to a point where people are setting up, living in parks, feeling that they have no other option? I do totally understand and respect that you are trying to provide other options, but it was a long journey to get here.
Well, in one word, Jane, pandemic. The pandemic created a significant issue, not just for Toronto. Cities around the world have been seeing this. We moved very, very quickly, though, to expand the shelter system, including 25 temporary shelters to create physical distancing. Hotels, as you and your listeners may well be aware, we have a number of hotels that we are leasing, providing safe, secure rooms, meals, laundry, harm reduction, medical and housing worker access, so services there, and improving the infection prevention and control within shelters, as well as created an isolation hotel for people who are homeless who contract COVID-19. So the pandemic forced people to not want to come into shelters for fear of contracting COVID, understandably. So we moved quickly to create a space within our shelter system, create spaces within our shelter system that were safe and that are safe. We don't have any outbreaks currently within our shelter system. We continue to vaccinate people who are experiencing homelessness. So we've taken a number of steps since the start of this pandemic to deal with those issues and to encourage people to come inside where it is safer. But at the outset, Jane, really the pandemic has been the issue. There are a number of people who were released from correctional facilities early in the pandemic who had no housing plan or anywhere to go. So the City of Toronto has the largest and most comprehensive shelter system in the country. does draw people to it as well. And a sense of community in these encampments. We fully understand that, and that's why we're leasing hotel space, for example, downtown, so that they are close to their supports, to their friends, to people who you know, require that those kinds of supports. So we're doing everything we possibly can to ensure that our most vulnerable have a safe space to go.
Well, help us understand why an individual would not take the city up on what sounds like a relatively attractive offer versus staying in a park in a lean-to situation.
Well, there are, you know, there are as many different reasons as there are people, of course. Some of the things we hear are the supports that I just discussed, you know, the sense of community that they have in an encampment, and some of the barriers, frankly. I mean, there are some rules that must be followed when you're in a shelter system, including the hotel program, that people don't wish to adhere to. There are people who, as I said earlier, were feeling unsafe about COVID-19, understandably. So we are doing everything we can to address that, including vaccinating people, not just in the shelter system, but also in encampments. We have mobile teams that have been doing that for the last several weeks. A sense of, I guess, what they would describe as safe, feeling unsafe in the shelter system for a variety of reasons. Shelter system, though, then shelters are temporary emergency solutions to people who are unhoused. And so that's why we provide access to a housing worker so that people who are in the shelter system can then be housed. And we have, in fact, housed more than 5,500 people since the start of the pandemic who were in the shelter system. So finding affordable housing for people, finding them supportive housing, helping them get things like identification, some fairly fundamental things that we, you and I, may take for granted. People don't have IDs, so we work with them to obtain those kinds of basics that we might refer to, and necessities to find then housing and income support, whether it's a job or otherwise. So we do quite a bit within the shelter system. Why do some people choose not to come in? I don't know. Mm. As I say, there's a myriad reasons, but I can tell you that many thousands do, and we continue to refer people inside. People continue to accept our referral. We estimate that perhaps maybe 300 to 400 people are living outside on any given day. It changes daily. It's a very dynamic sort of situation. There are four key encampments that we're aware of, that the people are aware of, at Trinity Bellwoods, Alexandra Park, Moss Park, and Lamport Stadium. And we see a number of referrals continue to occur on those sites, in addition to people who, yes, do refuse to accept our offers of service.
I'm speaking with Brad Ross, Toronto's Chief Communications Officer. How big of an issue is mental health in terms of reaching people who are mentally unhealthy and won't be receptive to any kind of assistance?
So, that's why we have Streets to Homes teams, both city staff as well as agency partners, who are trained to engage with people and create relationships with people who may have a range of issues, whether they're mental health issues or addictions of various kinds. There are, people who have significant challenges, absolutely, in the shelter system supports all of that. When they come inside, they get those supports from doctors, from counselors and others to help them with their addictions or medication if required for a mental health condition, for example. So yes, there's some of that, but again, it's these are individuals, people with who have come from various backgrounds, have individual kinds of issues, and that's why we work with people on an individual basis to find them the right supports that meet their individual needs. It's not it can never be a one-size-fits-all.
With the assistance that is going on from the City of Toronto, and certainly you see Mayor Tory's commitment to providing longer-lasting housing as well, how do you see success stories Do you see people overcome homelessness?
Oh, absolutely. We have a number of success stories. As I was saying, you know, since the start of the pandemic, more than 5,500 yes. people in the shelter system. And the shelter system, by the way, you know, houses or shelters about 6,000 people a night. So people are in the shelter system. The vast majority are in the shelter system for a very short period of time until they're housed. And so we have a number of programs underway with respect to affordable housing, modular housing. Since December of 2020, we've opened 244 new affordable and supportive housing homes, including 100 modular housing units. There are 82 projects in the pipeline right now as part of the city's affordable rental development housing development pipeline. That'll create another 10,000 and more, 10,600 new permanent affordable rental homes once they're completed. And over the next year, we're aiming to make at least another 1,240 new permanent and affordable and supportive housing opportunities that will be ready for occupancy. So do we see success with respect to housing people? Absolutely we do, and we will continue to do that work and talk about those successes and leverage those successes. And apologies for that. But it's something that we are very much committed to. You know, housing is the solution to right. homelessness. We all, I think, can agree on that. And the city is very much, and city council is very much committed to ending homelessness with housing.
Brad, we will leave it there. Always a pleasure to chat with you.
All right, Jane. Thanks so much.
Toronto's Chief Communications Officer, Brad Ross. Jane, for Libby, join me tomorrow when we will chat with our strategy panel. Always a spicy conversation. And Bob Komsic is up next with the news.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio with guest host Jane Brown.
Well, hello there. Libby is back on Wednesday. If you've been listening to Zoomer Radio News today, you've heard the story of 11 residents at a Brampton long-term care home who did not receive their medications as prescribed. After an internal investigation, Peel Police got involved and have since charged a nurse who worked at Grace Manor long-term care home with 11 counts of failing to provide the necessaries of life. The employee had already been dismissed. As if the situation in long-term care has not looked bleak enough as a result of COVID-19 and its deadly damage. Joining me to discuss this latest development, our Monday Zoomer Squad, David Kravitz, Chief Membership Officer at CARP and Vice President at Zoomer Media, Bill Van Gorder, Chief Operating Officer and Chief Policy Officer at CARP, and Peter Mugridge, Senior Editor of Zoomer Magazine. Hello, Zoomer Squad.
Hi, Jane. How are you, everybody?
Hi, Jane.
Good to talk with you all again. Bill, I will start with you. How could this have happened, especially in light of policy changes after former nurse Elizabeth Wetlaufer went on her killing spree by injecting insulin into patients of long-term care? I mean, that is the first thing we all think of.
Well, it is. And it's the first question that comes to all of our minds. How could this happen? What's the supervision that takes place? What's the record keeping? We understood that when medication is administered, records are kept and somebody supervises those records. How could it go on 11 different times? You know, the good news, I guess, is that they caught this indiscretion. The bad news is how many other times is this common? We've been told by some people that it's not unusual for a nurse on their shift to find herself or himself get so busy, they leave it to the next shift. Is that what's happening? Where's the supervision? Where's the oversight? Where are these inspectors that we keep hearing about? it raises way more questions than just one about one nurse and some incidences.
Well, and I want to put that those questions and get your reaction as well. If you have a loved one in long-term care, has medication dispensing been an issue with your loved one? Has it been put off, as Bill mentioned, to the next shift? Was there a mistake? Do you have a story that sounds similar to what we're talking about in the news today? Numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. David Kravitz, what about you? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I share Bill's concerns, particularly in the fact that it's one individual and it's 11 occasions. I suppose if there's any good news here, it was according to the news reports that it was reported by the other staff at the home, and it was investigated by the management, and it was the management who reported it to the police. So there is some, local, I guess supervision may be late, and I think they management also announced they're going to review all their procedures. I don't think this is the kind of incident that necessarily can make it up all the way up the food chain to the ministry and their inspections, because it seems to be very localized and was dealt with locally. But I think it may speak to, and Bill alluded to this as well, is it overwork? Is it shortage of staff? I don't know whether failing to provide, the news report said charged. So is this under the criminal code? Because if it's a criminal investigation, then it's probably not a, systemic thing in the whole system.
Right. We don't know at this point whether there was any intent or, if the individual was tired, overworked. Peter, we don't know yet any of the details of the allegations.
Yeah, it's a developing story. And, it will be interesting to hear her in court and hear, was she just a sort of a renegade nurse, or whether, the circumstances that led her to not providing the medication are common throughout nursing homes. So it's a developing story. It's not a great news story, especially with all the other bad news surrounding long-term care homes and their failure to provide, adequate care during the pandemic. It's a terrible add-on to that. But we really have to wait to the court date to see what she says.
Our listeners want to get in on this conversation as well. Let's go to Tony in Keswick. Tony, what would you like to add?
Yeah, good morning. Good morning. Enjoy your show. Yeah, both my sisters worked in these places, and one especially was worked in one in West Chile. I ain't going to mention a name unless you want me to. but there was such stuff going on you wouldn't believe, stealing some jewelry from people, staff was doing that. And not to mention, leaving people in feces for the next shift to do it. And
right.
This is they have an hour and a half to kill. And she got a lot of, she was a nutritionist there. She took care of the kitchen matter, but she actually ended up changing some people herself because the people just saying, leave it for the next shift. There should be some kind of you have a health inspector, should be some kind of a government inspector going in there, without them even knowing and periodically, whatever, you do a drug test and go in there and have a look. It's a lot of stuff going on with a lot of people. Both my sisters retired early because they couldn't take it anymore.
Oh, no, I believe it. Thanks, Tony. Thanks for calling in. Bill, we heard a lot about during COVID and after the Elizabeth Wetlaufer commission that, there were concerns around how the shift was made up of professionals. You have all kinds of PSWs and one nurse who's dispensing medication. So do we have any more checks and balances in the system?
Well, we don't seem to have. We know there's a huge shortage of nurses, and they're the nurses that are on duty, we're told, are mainly there in a supervisory or a senior role. And do they have enough time to do their nursing duties? We've doubted that for some time, that there's adequate staffing able to look after the necessities of life of the people that they're looking after. We hear about not having enough to give the kind of daily care that we expect our loved ones to get in long-term care. Now we're hearing an incident, as David and Peter have both said, that could well be overwork and a case of one nurse not having the time to do everything she's being asked for.
Right. If you have two nurses on the same shift, they can check each other's work and make sure that nothing's getting missed.
Yeah. You can, but if you only have one nurse on the shift, if it's up to the next shift to pick up from the nursing shift that's left, then there's all kinds of opportunities for it to drop between the cracks. You know, as we talk about this, as Peter said, it's a breaking story. I think we have to be pretty careful about making particular accusations against this one nurse. This is more of a system problem we're probably seeing here, and inadequate staffing and inadequate support. And it's quite possible that this one nurse just got caught in the middle of a situation that was nothing of her doing.
Well, we are speculating, but David, what do you think? I mean, is this woman more likely to be overworked and tired than someone like an Elizabeth Wetlaufer?
Well, I think there's a very clear distinction. In the case of Elizabeth Wetlaufer, you had criminal intent.
Yes.
You had willful murder. There was no suggestion that she injected all those people because she was, you know, forgetful or overworked. This was a criminal intent to commit murder. And I don't think a system other than the criminal justice system can anticipate all of those things at every level, whether it's in a hospital or a nursing home or a school or anywhere else. In this case, I just don't know. But I would want to point out one interesting and disturbing thing, I suppose, is that when you go back to the Morocco Commission, the Commission of Inquiry into the whole problem, they pointed out that the nursing homes as an industry, as a service, fall kind of in between. They're not quite of the Ministry of Health. They're not quite from their own ministry. They attribute a lot of problems to this kind of neither here nor there existence, where conditions were allowed to exist that would never be tolerated, for example, in a hospital, because the hospitals are part of the Ministry of Health and they come under, you know, an act of the legislature, and they need to provide certain levels of service. And long-term care homes are kind of, sort of, in a way, yes, but no. And I think that's part of the problem here, is that they're not required and they're not staffed at the level that would be insisted upon in hospitals. And so you're left in this kind of limbo land where you're hoping that everything turns out okay. Grossly inadequate inspections, only in response to complaints, and always in no surprise inspections, no unplanned inspections from the home's point of view. So I think it's this kind of weird hybrid we have that's part of the health system, but not part of the health system, that is very responsible for some of these problems that we're experiencing.
Peter, I guess the one heartening element of this is that, according to the CEO of Holland Christian Homes, which is responsible for Grace Manor long-term care, they actually conducted the investigation and went to police. They didn't try to hide what was going on.
Yeah, and there was no... They seem to be fully transparent here, although they're not really commenting on the specifics of the case. But they seem to be working with police and the government, and that's a really good thing, because you know, it took the military report and it took the Auditor General report and the Morocco Commission to shine a light on these homes. But maybe we're in a new era where these homes will shine a light on themselves, and you know, like, sort of admit publicly that the problem exists, mm-hmm. and show the public what they're doing about it. I think it's comforting in a way that they got on top of it, they dealt with it, and they contacted the police.
True. You're listening to Zoomer Radio's Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Libby is off today. It's Jane for Libby and the Zoomer Squad, Peter Mugrich, David Kravitz, and Bill Van Gorder. Let's go back to the phones. Marzia in Vaughan, you have a story to share?
Yes, I do, and it's a very sad story, too. Mom was in respite in one of the homes that the military was in during COVID last year, and she did not get her medication. She was there for 2 days on respite. She was on respite. We put her in there for a break. My sister needed a break. She was not administered her medication. it was 32 degrees in her room, and the window would not open, it would not close. It was always open, but you couldn't open it any further, and you couldn't close it. And for 2 days, Mom was in there, and a friend went to visit her, and she was calling for help through the friend. The friend called us, and my sister and I darted down there. We were there within 7 minutes, and we looked it up, and we talked it over, and my sister and I said, okay, let's leave her there for another day. Saturday morning at 8 o'clock, I woke up in desperation, and I called my sister. I said, we need to go and get Mom. Mm-hmm. So we went, and we were packing her clothes, and we spoke with the head nurse, and we said, could we have a list of the medication that she was administered, because we don't want to remedicate her. She said, we don't have any medication for her. I said, what are you talking about? We gave you a list before she came in. Plus, she was there a year before from convalescent. And it was the same head nurse that we spoke to. And we had given her a list of medication. And none of her medication was administered for 2 days.
So, Marzia, was her health affected? I mean, other than the obvious things you pointed out, how did she manage after that?
She declined. She went downhill. We had to put her in a nursing home. She was there for a year and a half, and we lost her this September.
I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
Well, Bill,
she declined very, very rapidly, and we contested. We called the ministry. They went in. They said there was an inspection. Everything was done, but apparently nothing came through. She declined very, very rapidly.
Well, and Marzia, you can imagine for those family members who aren't able to take their loved ones out. I mean, your mom was in this this horrific situation for a matter of days, it sounds like, and mm-hmm. she was struggling afterwards. Can you imagine those who are in there for long periods of time?
Yes. Another point I would like to make out is we asked why she was not administered her meds, and they said that it was because the doctor put them on hold. It wasn't any of the nurses. It wasn't any of the PSWs. It was the doctor that said that put them on hold, and he wanted to reinvestigate. And I thought, well, what's there to investigate? If she's been giving these meds when she was here on convalescent, why are you not able to administer them that she's here on respite?
And what was the answer to your question of why would the doctor do this?
He said it was his calling, and it was up to him to decide.
Wow. Well, yes, thank you very much. Thank you for sharing your story. It's brave to have to retell difficult details, and we do appreciate it.
They're still sending us bills for it.
Oh, they are they?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I'll let our Zoomer squad react to your story. Again, thank you for calling in, Bill. When you hear a story like that.
Yeah, just so sad. And our heart goes out to the family that had to deal with that and the recently departed, to know that people can be treated like that, even when their family tries to intervene. It's such a sad situation. And, you know, it does bring up another issue, and that's the issue of the decision making power that nurses have or don't have when it comes to daily care. CARP has always advocated that it should be a person centered system where the person, the individual, the resident gets the care that they need when they need it, and when decisions are being made at a distance, even by an expert like a doctor, and nurses who are giving the day-to-day care, who aren't right with the patient, aren't able to influence those decisions. There's something the matter with the whole system. We need to have the people who are closest to the patients able to make the decisions that are necessary to keep them comfortable when they need to be, and not wait days for someone really outside of the personal care picture, making decisions about them.
Well, David, that just seems to be hard to believe that a doctor would make that decision and yet not consult with family members first.
Well, I think it would be very rare. If I go back to my earlier point in a hospital, I mean, I would ask, where's the family doctor who prescribed the meds in the first place? Her mother was on a medication. It wasn't like an acute treatment of surgery or some post-surgical procedure where the operating room is making decisions, which, you know, they have to make. This is the families, and the first answer was, well, we don't have any meds for her. And then they explained to the doctor, well, doesn't the doctor have to talk to the family and let them know? Doesn't he have to consult with the family physician?
Right.
Do they do all, which I, so I'm suggesting here, and I don't know, I don't want to pretend to all levels of procedural expertise that I don't have, but I'm suggesting here that it's loose again. It's not the what you'd expect in a hospital. And it's because this setting falls in the limbo land of it's medical, it's quasi, it's not really. And that's why you get these communication breakdowns and these breakdowns in treatment, because they're not, they're a quasi medical facility and they don't really fall under anybody.
And along those lines, Peter, we've yet to hear any kind of reaction to this story from the long-term care ministry.
Yeah, I suppose they're waiting till the facts are in, or they've had a chance to look at the facts. But you know, this I think they're going to find this isn't an isolated problem. Like one of the recommendations from the Wettlaufer inquiry was that nursing homes, long term care facilities, had to sort of improve the way they deliver medication and the way they keep records of it. And I know the government recently issued grants to these homes so they could update their systems and sort of, you know, purchase new technology that would allow them to keep track of the medications in a more effective manner. So perhaps, you know, going forward, this might be, let's put some more money against it. Let's jumpstart this. Let's get this into all homes so we can avoid these cases where the nurses are overworked, the nurses are pushing it off to the next staff, they've lost track, the doctors have counter-ordered what the patients need. Like an effective operating system, effective technology could get around that.
I want to go back to the phones. If you're just joining us here on Zoomer Radio's Fight Back, we're talking about the story of a nurse at a Brampton long-term care home charged after a medication incident involving 11 individual residents. Let's go to Wendy in Midland. Wendy, go ahead.
Oh, hello, Janet. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. What's your story?
I'm a registered nurse, and I've been working for many, many years. I'm still registered, but I am in my 70s. And I do nursing assessments in retirement homes for other countries and other countries, other companies, and in retirement homes and long-term care homes. And I've been finding that more individual families are putting cameras in the rooms of individual patients, and it seems like you know, the facilities are accepting this, and I don't know if that's a solution to some of the problems.
I'm wondering, Bill, does that have to be disclosed? I would think it would be.
They know.
I see.
Retirement home knows, or the nursing home knows, that there's a camera in the room.
Right.
But there's more. Like, there's not a lot of them, but certainly more than there was 10 years ago when I was working in the same job.
Well, thank you for calling in.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I appreciate that insight. Bill, what about that? I mean, more accountability. We all know that smartphones and technology are revealing crimes, right, all the time. Is this the way to go, more surveillance?
Well, it may be what's going to happen, whether we like it or not. But isn't it sad? Isn't it so terrible to think that we're losing such trust in those facilities where we have we're given the responsibility for looking after our loved ones, that we even have to think that we have to follow up this way and supervise and be there all the time to make you sure that they're getting the care that we just rightfully expect that they're going to get. And I think for the long-term care homes, the lack of trust that this is all the whole
COVID experience has engendered in them is, in the long run, going to completely change the attitudes. We're already hearing even more so of people not wanting to put their loved ones in long-term care because of what they're hearing. So it's going to take tremendous change to regain that trust again. And if putting cameras in the homes to protect your own loved ones is what you have to do, who can blame any family for wanting to do that?
Before we wrap up with our Zoomer Squad final thoughts here on this Monday, June 14th, there's actually, just the way it worked out, Bill, a show you're part of tonight on the Zoomer on our sister station Vision TV at 11, advocating with a panel of experts, yourself included, on the need to put more money in keeping people at home.
Exactly. That's right. And that's what's happening. And we know that the answer to many of these questions for many people in the long run is, how do we make our homes, our communities, our home care available so that as many people as possible don't have to go into long-term care facilities that, as David said, are not seem to be able to provide the care that they need because they're neither a medical facility or a residence or somewhere in between, and it's just not being managed well.
David, your final thoughts on this segment?
Well, I agree with that. I think the cameras are in there primarily to prevent abuse, verbal and physical abuse. I don't think the cameras could record the delivery of meds on time, even with a time code on it. But I think it's a good step. But I think that what Bill said is correct, that we're entitled to expect a certain level. And when it comes to meds, to go back to the story, there's no reason that they mustn't, never mind shouldn't, mustn't be, they must be delivered. There's no reason they mustn't be delivered as expected, properly on time. And if the home doesn't have the resources to do that, that should be knowable and disclosable and dealt with the same as if it was a hospital that wasn't giving medication properly. So it needs a fresh look and it needs very aggressive corrective action by the ministry, even though this management may not be culpable, as Peter pointed out. Kudos to them for recognizing it and identifying it. But what are they wrestling with that prevents them from delivering the service that people expect?
Yeah, good question. And Peter, the final word to you.
Yeah, well, I'll be following the outcome of this closely, you know, because it's hopefully it's just an isolated incident, but you know, there is a potential it could open a can of worms, and that you know, the evidence raised could show that this is going on in other homes, and that you know, it's just another you know, set of problems that the industry has to face down among the many they have. So I'll be watching the case very closely.
Zoomer Squad, I thank you, and Libby, we'll talk with you again next Monday.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks everyone. Jane.
That is Peter Muggeridge, senior editor of Zoomer Magazine, along with Bill Van Gorder, chief operating officer and chief policy officer of CARP, and David Kravitz, chief membership officer at CARP and vice president at Zoomer Media. Jane, for Libby, and after the break, have you been to an outdoor patio since Ontario entered step one of the roadmap to reopening plan? We want to hear about your experience. 416-360-0740 or 1-866-740-4740.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.